What draws you to keep going towards danger rather than away from it?
I went to Chechnya, for instance, which is probably the most dangerous place you can be gay in the world. And I met the guy who's basically responsible for rounding gay people up. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, this guy has no idea that I'm gay.
There's a particular point where you're talking about suicide. What do you wish people understood?
Investigating my dad's illness, one thing was very clear, was that he got a lot more help in the mid-1990s than he would have done now.
God, that is just going to make me weep.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of those shaping our common life. Today's guest is James Longman, who is the chief foreign correspondent for the US news network ABC News, and the author of a new book, The Inherited Mind, a story of family, hope, and the genetics of mental health. I really hope you enjoy listening.
James, you are very kindly speaking to us from Ukraine. Your mind may be in on many other things, and I'm going to be very mean and ask you a big, juicy question. There's no warm-up. There's no, what did you have for breakfast? It's straight in there with something that is trying to get to your deep values, the principles that you are at least attempting to live by, and we all fail, at least attempting to live by. And I frame that as, what are your sacred values? What is sacred to you? But you can take that in whatever direction you like and just see what bubbles up. Just riff for me for a minute or two, if that's okay.
I would say, because I'm in Ukraine, so work is at the forefront of my mind, kindness is really the thing that I try and likely fail to live by, because it has always helped me in my work. I always feel very strongly that doing what I do, often I meet a person probably at the worst time in their entire life. There's no real other reason why I will come into your life other than to document something horrible that's happened to you. Most of the time, sometimes I get to do fun things, but when you work in international news, often it's sad. And there's a transactional nature to my work where I have to say to someone, you need to give me a moment of your time, 5 minutes, half an hour, a day. And in return, really all I have to give you is my kindness, because there's not much else in it for you. Let's be honest. I mean, a Ukrainian who's lost their home to a Russian bomb will not probably see their life improved by interacting with me. I mean, I like to think, and we all have these highfalutin ideas in journalism, that what we do makes a difference. And maybe the sum total of what we do does. And occasionally I've gone and done stories where if someone has appeared on television and as a result of my report, they might access more help, a charity might get in touch. They can, you know, there are ways in which they will benefit. But broadly speaking, I have to basically hope that they will just speak to me because I'm nice to them. And I don't want to go away from that interaction feeling like I've taken advantage of them. And so really, in some ways, it's selfish. I want them to feel that I've been kind because I don't want to feel bad. But I also really deeply want them to know that I really care about what's happened to them. And you can't, and people see through it. The audience sees through it. I think the audience kind of gets a sense of authenticity. So for all those reasons, I think that kindness, it's served me in my work. People remember it, and it is the thing that I think about most when I'm working.
It's beautiful to hear you say that. And often when I'm talking to people in professions that are up against the hard bits of life regularly, I think about you know, the traditional professions that did this, kind of priests primarily, met people in their hardest moments. Therapists, all of those people have structures of support, right, and accountability, and they are trained to know how to process the fact that someone has handed them their sadness and they've been alongside people in their darkness. I have a kind of CJ from the West Wing soft spot for journalists and have always felt this like desire to create some sort of mass chaplaining for journalists. How do you process the things that you are seeing and keep the ability to stay kind? You know, you said in your book, you use this phrase about sometimes journalists cope ugly, right? It all comes out sideways. What has helped you maintain the ability to show up with kindness and not let the kind of things that you're saying harden your heart? not the kind of things that you're seeing harden your heart?
I have an ability, and I think lots of us do, when you're in the moment, when you're having to do a job, you put the trauma of it to one side. And I was with friends the other day, and I was talking to a doctor about this, and he deals in pediatric emergency care. You can only imagine the kinds of things he's dealing with. I mean, much more serious than what I do. I mean, he's actually saving lives. But he can put the trauma of it to one side because he's got a job to do. So that's the first instance. That's what I'm doing. I'm trying to make sure that it doesn't affect me too much in the moment because I've got a job to do. But more than that, and the way that I think that I have a lot in common with my dad is that I wanted to make sure I was doing a job where I was feeling things, because I think, maybe I've been at an American network for too long, but there's this phrase where there's feeling, there's meaning. But for me, that's really true, because I just wanted a job where my emotions were being accessed. So whether that's anger or sadness or, being afraid, I mean, that's part of this job, right? You know, you might be in places where things are a bit dangerous, but where my feelings are constantly being activated, that is what drives me. So, if I feel really moved by someone's story, for me, I feel very lucky because I'm doing something which I value and where I feel like I might, in that horribly naive way that journalists operate, might make a difference. And I want the audience to feel something as well.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. But first, I want to give our listeners a sense of who you are and where you've come from. So tell me a bit about your childhood. What were the big influences, the big ideas that were in the air, maybe like primary school years when you were younger than 10?
Goodness. So I was born and raised in West London. I'm an only child. My parents split when I was 3. And I was made aware quite early that my dad was not very well and he had schizophrenia. But I didn't know that. I didn't really understand in a way a child doesn't. So my dad really was kind of like a friend. He was kind of in orbit around us. He only lived around the corner and I'd see him occasionally. I suppose one of the biggest influences in my life was my grandmother. My mum is part Lebanese and my grandmother was Lebanese and they had moved around a lot. They had been refugees many times over. My mum was born in Egypt and my grandparents had met in the war there. But when the war finished, they moved around a lot. They'd lived in Libya. They'd lived in Iraq, in Lebanon. They were fleeing war and revolution all the time and then eventually came to settle in the UK. So my grandmother had this kind of wonderfully kind of international flair about her, but she was deeply religious. So my grandmother basically came to live with us essentially after my father had died. And, it was a little bit like a Franco-Arab version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I kind of lived with my grandparents and my mother in this kind of multilingual, multicultural environment where you had my grandfather, who was a New Zealander, you know, former army major, married to this Lebanese woman, my grandmother, who was very glamorous. She always wore, these kind of floral silk shift dresses. She always smelled of rose water. She had deep red lipstick all the time, big white hair. And she was really kind of a massive influence in my life until she died when I was 14. So I think my life when I was young, it felt quite disjointed because I was an only child in this kind of weird family which didn't look like other families. And I was always conscious of not really looking like other families. And then when I was 8 years old, I was sent away to boarding school, very English boarding school. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was sent away from an environment which was full of love in many ways, but was also quite kind of chaotic, and we'll kind of come on to why. But when I went to school, everything kind of made sense. I was in this kind of English environment where there were rules and there were boundaries. And I loved it. I spent 10 years of my life up until I was 18 there. But that Catholic background remained because it was a Catholic boarding school. And that was the reason why I was sent there. So this kind of the ethos, the Catholic ethos, the saints, the constant praying, it was still in my life until I was 18.
There's this beautiful vignette in the book about your grandmother, who I just fell in love with through your words. Can you tell me about her, the rosary beads over her bed?
Yeah, there were all kinds of things in the house. There were like pictures of various different saints. She would constantly be praying to St. Anthony every time anything got lost. And over her bed, I always remember these huge rosary beads, and each bead was probably about the size of my head. And if it fell, you were going to die. I mean, there was no question of it. I mean, if anyone was lying on that pillow, they were gone. She was amazing. She eventually, we moved around a lot. And when we lived in France and when she sadly died, I think my favorite story of hers was where she was on her deathbed and she was 96 when she died. And she's lying there. And in the way the Lebanese do, she was giving my mother all her rice recipes and sort of family secrets and telling her which jewels she wanted to be buried in and all this sort of stuff. And then she had had this long running feud with a cousin who she had lent a christening gown to. I was supposed to be christened in this christening gown, right? My grandmother had been making it for years and years and years. It was huge. She lent it to this woman, André, and André never gave it back. And my grandmother never forgave her. She held a grudge against her for 14 years, the duration of my life. And then she was lying on her deathbed and she says to my mother, "And tell André." And my mother thought, oh, she's gonna let this go. "I will never forgive her." And then she died, which I love. And it tells you what you need to know about my grandmother. She was a very loving, lovely woman, but she was very proud and superstitious as well.
Yeah. And the other character that comes through so vividly and tenderly is your dad. So tell me a little bit more about who he was and his life.
So my dad was an artist. He was kind of bohemian type in West London. This was Notting Hill in the 1980s when I was born. This is before the movie, before it became chic. I mean, you go there now and it's all kind of acai bowls and downward dog. That's not
when the carnival was launched and it was actually rooted in the,
yeah, in the, it, well, absolutely in the culture of the area, but it was also kind of the sort of area of lots of sort of bohemian intellectuals and artists. And my dad was one of these people. He was an art student. He tried to become a lawyer, but then had just decided that really wasn't for him. He wanted to do something creative, and his mother and his brother were both artists, and he became an artist. But when he was 21, he had a major psychotic break, and his family realized that he had schizophrenia, and he was in and out of psychiatric care for many years. He actually met my mum in the early 70s in London, and they were engaged to be married. And then he had a psychotic break, and he left, and he went to live in Switzerland with the Maharishi, who founded Transcendental Meditation. And so my dad was in the mix, in this kind of heady 1960s, 70s mix of the early days of Transcendental Meditation. You know, the Beatles were big on this. It was really an exciting time for young people, but he was carried away into this movement of deep and intense meditation, which the family all said was part of the reason why he ended up getting schizophrenia. They think that it triggered something in him. And there's a chapter in the book about the links between meditation and schizophrenia for that reason. Anyway, he eventually came back to London 10 years on, and then he knocked at my mum's door and said, "Now I'm ready to marry you." And they got married and had me. But soon after, these psychotic illnesses kind of returned. And when I was 9 years old, he set fire to the flat he was living in, and he then threw himself from the window and he died. And his whole life, really, for me, for my life, my, you know, during my childhood and really until quite recently, really has been defined by that. You know, when someone ends their life, that's all really anyone remembers or thinks about. And they become this sort of sick person who killed themselves. And I've spent, you know, the last few years writing this book and rediscovering who he was away from the illness. Really talented, creative, funny, quirky individual who was really loved by a lot of people. I managed to find his art school colleagues, peers, other students who were with him, his cohort, his first girlfriend, the carers who looked after him at various points in his life. And really, I've been able to build a picture outside of just the sort of sadness of his suicide.
And am I right in thinking you weren't told that that's how he died at the time?
Yeah, that's right. So I was told that there'd been a fire. The first chapter of the book deals with how I'm told by a housemaster at the school I was at, and just that there was a fire and that there wasn't anything they could do. And then I just found it kind of, I remember it just feeling it was a bit weird. I didn't really know, something other than just a fire had happened, but no one really explained what. And I always remember at the funeral, my uncle's wife read a poem about how he was finally free. And I remember sitting there in that church, I was 9, and I always remember having this memory of just sitting there thinking, what does that mean? Like, what do you mean he's finally free? He's died. It's not a good thing. And then it wasn't really until much later, and I started to develop my own sadness. I got into some deeply depressive episodes when I was in my 20s, that I started to wonder, like, what actually happened here? My relationship with my mother kind of broke down, and I was told that he had killed himself, I think sometime in my teenage years. My mother had told me during a fight. But I didn't really know the details. And so when I started, like I said, getting a bit sad, and then I started to try to investigate why that might be, and I was offered the opportunity. I was working at the BBC at the time, and I did a small piece on the issue. I went to the library, the archive, to find out what had happened, and I discovered that he'd set fire to this building, that he'd jumped out of a window. And that was when I was 26. So it took a long time to actually realize what had actually happened to him. Because I think one of the big themes of the book is really, it's just family. Why we are the way we are. Why we are, what makes us products of our families, and the secrets and the shame that pervade in families when a major trauma happens, and especially something like mental illness and suicide.
Yeah. Because there's another piece of the puzzle that you've been putting together, isn't there, around your dad's dad?
That's right. So it wasn't until doing this that I then found out that his dad had also ended his life. And it remains a bit of a mystery. I mean, I was told in a vague sense because he'd been given a prostate cancer diagnosis. But even then, I don't think that anyone really knew if there was anything else happening. I was told that he had shot himself in the family garden at a time of day when he knew his son would be there, my dad, and he wanted my dad to find his body. And my dad would have been in his early 20s when this happened, just at the time he was already experiencing psychotic illness. So quite why you would plan your own death in order for your son to find your body when you know your son's already going through something. He did it so that he didn't want his wife, my grandmother, to find the body. So then, and then, through further conversations, but never directly with the person, I find out my uncle, my dad's brother, also had schizophrenia and was put into psychiatric care. I mean, I knew my uncle. He only died a couple of years ago. I didn't see him in the last 10 years of his life, but it was never really discussed. And so then I just thought, hang on, I've got a dad who ended his life and who had schizophrenia. I've got an uncle who had schizophrenia. I've got a grandfather who killed himself. Wow. It's not looking good. And so when I was feeling sad, I just thought, well, then is this written? Is it in my code? Is this sort of predetermined in some way that I was always going to get sad? How does that work? And that's what set me on the path to writing the book.
I want to come back to kind of what you found and what it might mean for those of us trying to understand each other better. But let's just fill in some gaps, because you went to study Arabic and ended up in Syria, I think, for studies initially. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I got to the sort of university, I thought, well, what can I do which is going to allow me to travel? That's all I really wanted to do. I wanted to escape. That was basically my plan. And my grandmother was always in my heart, really. I just always thought about her, and being in the Middle East seemed like a natural thing to do. So I went to do a degree in Arabic. I lived in Syria to do that, which, if you know anything about the Middle East, for a Lebanese person, that would be exactly the wrong place to go and live. But I did anyway, because I wanted to be close to Lebanon. It borders Syria. I went to live in Syria, fell in love with it. And then I did a master's when, again, I was focused on Syria. And then the war started in 2011. It was the protest movement. If you remember all those years ago, or actually in the news at the moment, you're seeing, that war bubble back up again. But this was in 2011. And I went really to do my thesis for my master's, and I realized that I was in the right place at the right time to write for the newspapers, because they weren't allowing journalists in. I had a visa. I was able to be there. And so I started writing for British newspapers under an assumed name. I wasn't really there. Well, I wasn't there legally as a journalist. And that's where really my journalism career kind of got started.
Yes. And you've, been in the most astonishing situations, right up close to some of the most dangerous and impactful events of our time. What draws you to keep doing this job, essentially, to keep going towards danger rather than away from it?
I find it quite exciting to be in a place where some consequential things are happening. I feel like, it's a way of not being a passive passenger in the world. It's a way of being a sort of proactive, participant in world events. There's something very exciting about being in the place where something is happening right this minute. I mean, every time anything happens anywhere in the world, my immediate thought is, how can I get there? What would be the quickest way? Are there planes still going? Who would go with me? Will ABC be interested in this story? How can I sell it to my network so that they're interested? It's about being in a place where something is happening and making people understand that the world is bigger than the space that they occupy. What you realize when you do this job and you speak to people all over the world is that we all basically have exactly the same needs and desires. You can speak to a yoga instructor in LA or a mother of seven children in a refugee camp in Iraq, and basically they want the same things. They want to be happy. They want their children to be okay. They want to be fed. They want to have a future. So trying to explain to people who live slightly more comfortable lives that everyone else really wants what they've got, I think I quite like that challenge as well.
One of the things I most appreciate about the book is how honestly you're wrestling with the ethics of what you do and the responsibility of it. And I do, a lot of my work has been around cultural stories. I started at the BBC and then I ran a think tank. And I'm fascinated by these kind of ambient narratives that shape our common life, the way they shape us. They make some things seem legitimate and some things seem illegitimate. They make some people seem like the good guys and some people seem like the bad guys. Some life choices are okay, some are not, And it's mostly implicit. It is not explicit. It is just the sort of sum total of the cultural stories. You see this very interesting thing about how you choose what stories to cover. What is the responsibility of the kind of editorial instinct within news to go, okay, there's all these things happening in the world all the time. Which ones are important enough for our viewers to know about? And what is the role of, despair and hope? What are we actually implicitly claiming about what the world is like and what humans are like? Could you just unpack for us a little bit about some of your thinking around that? Because I found it really interesting.
Look, I always say that I didn't get into this job to depress people. I don't want to spread gloom. And so many people, especially people my age, you have dinner parties and people say, I don't watch the news. It's really depressing. And that kind of is troubling because I think, I don't know if I would go so far as say it's a duty, but I think it is important that we do know what's happening in the rest of the world, because whether you like it or not, it will end up affecting you. How we decide what a story is, there are so many different things that go into it. I mean, broadly speaking, it's, can we make this understandable for an American audience? I think what people have to understand is that the knowledge base and point of departure in the United States is just that much lower than it would be in Europe, just because of geography. Americans tend to know a little bit less about the rest of the world than the average European might. It's not, I'm not judging anyone. That's just the reality of it. Plus, the media landscape in the States is so much more varied. So you've really got to fight for space and attention and really telling them about the sort of tiny story in X country is not going to cut through. So you just have to be realistic about it. But for me, what guides me often, and what American television actually does really well, and I would argue better than it did when I was at the BBC, is provide people with a bit of hope, even for the most hopeless stories. You have to do that. There's a reason why the most clicked on story at the BBC will not be about Syria or, you know, Ukraine. It'll be about a panda or about, you know, an amazing snowman somewhere. And that's not because we're idiots. It's because we want to be happy. And naturally, people want to be happy. So if I can figure out a way to make my Syria story give them a bit of the panda, you know, it sounds trite, but that's really what I have to try to do, then, you know, then I'm happy. I mean, the thing I always remember is one of the things that formed me as a journalist. I covered the Bataclan attacks, people will remember, in 2016. And one of the victims' husbands, this woman had died, she'd been killed inside the theater. And this was a father of two small children and now a widower. He wrote a letter to the killers, forgiving them. He wrote this beautiful letter saying, "I cannot teach my children hate. I have to teach them forgiveness. And for that reason, I forgive you for what you did to my wife." I thought it was incredible that he'd written this. We went to his house. We asked him if he could just simply read the letter to our cameras. He did. It became the most watched thing the BBC had ever done at that point, which is insane, right? But it's because he was giving people a bit of hope. Yeah, you know, through the letter, through the information around it on the website, you would find out the facts about what had happened and the very sad situation. But really, at its center, it was because he was giving people some hope. And that, I think, I've got to try and do that with what I do as well.
Yes. It's so interesting, isn't it? I think of attention is a moral act. Like, we can choose what we attend to, and what we attend to changes us. And I think a lot of people's resistance watching news is the sense that that sort of overwhelming horror is changing them and making them shut down and be cynical or whatever. And the desire to protect ourselves from it. I think it's quite a difficult balancing act to attend to sort of the true suffering of the world, but also attend to the true beauty of the world, right? And the potential for goodness and hope. I wonder if you continue to have any kind of spiritual frame for things, because this is often where people find the place that helps them balance those two things. How much does your grandmother's Catholicism leave a mark on you?
I say to people that I'm culturally Catholic in the same way as you can be culturally Jewish. I feel, and not religiously Jewish in any way, but, you know, you're part of a wider group. I feel that about being Catholic. I mean, my mom, I always remember, like, if she's asking after someone on television, she says, "Oh, who's this? I've not seen them before." And if she finds out they're Catholic, she's like, "Oh, I knew they're Catholic. I knew I'd like them." That's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's completely an insane thing to say.
Scientists call it homophily. People like me syndrome. We all do it.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing. It's this kind of shared sort of ephemeral thing that you just know that someone is nice because they're Catholic. And I mean, it's just bonkers, and it isn't obviously always true. Anyway, so that's how I feel about it. And there are people in my life who were so important to me, right? So my grandmother, some of the priests at my school. So I was at a Catholic boarding school run by Benedictine monks. The ethos of St. Benedict is about community. And I think that really, really played a big part in my life, you know, thinking about what you can do to contribute to community, looking out for other people, thinking very deeply about being part of a group. I mean, as an only child, that was so important to me because I grew up really on my own, and I got to a school where it was all about, well, you're in a community now and you have to look out for each other. I'll always remember there was a boy who sadly died very young. I think it was 13. And the entire school, all 450 boys, we lined the path to the church through the whole school as his funeral went through, as his casket was carried. And I just thought it was the most powerful thing, because we'd all come and we'd all shown up for his family. Even if you'd asked those boys to recite various different prayers, they probably may not have known off by heart. I mean, most of us did, because you had to go like three times a week. But how Catholic are we in a capital C terms? I'm not sure, but I absolutely feel it. I always, if I'm in a foreign country and there's a beautiful church, I will light a candle for my mom, my grandmother, because I know she would have liked it. I met the Pope and I told him about my grandmother. In very bad, you have to speak to him in Italian. And I was told a phrase in Italian and I can't remember it now. But I just said my grandmother would have been very proud. And he kind of took my hand and held it. And then I felt my grandmother. She would have gone absolutely mental if she'd known that I met the Pope. She absolutely would have gone crazy. The best thing I've ever done in my whole life would have been to meet the Pope. And the people who shaped me, who I remember, I was told about her death by our headmaster at the time at my school. And he was a priest, Father Christopher. And so if there are people who are important to you in your life and they are religious, as most of them have been for me, then I can't help but think that there might be something in it. Even if I'm not, I wouldn't count myself to be a religious person.
I want to ask you something that may be crossing a boundary, and I love a good boundary, so feel free to push back, and also we can edit. But I've been thinking, your book is just—it's basically a love letter to Alex, isn't it? It's this incredibly beautiful Sorry, I'm going to cry now. Incredibly beautiful testimony to his love for you, your husband's love for you. And there's one of the things you write about is the complexity of being kind of publicly gay on social media and in the book, because of some of the places you report, right? Because that puts you in danger in some places. So I'd love you to say a little bit about that. And if you're willing, how that has played out in terms of your thinking about faith and religion and whether it's been a point of tension.
Well, being gay in the public eye, and doing my job. I often think about it in a few ways when it comes to doing my actual job. So I think about it, if I'm in a place where it's not okay to be gay, I went to Chechnya, for instance, which is probably the most dangerous place you can be gay in the world. I mean, I don't know if there's a ranking, but I mean, given that they just summarily execute gay people. And I met the guy who's basically responsible for rounding gay people up. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, this guy has no idea that I'm gay. Like just didn't know, because I wasn't the idea he has of a gay person, which often if you go to some parts of the world, they have stereotypes of gay people and they're basically, you have to be incredibly effeminate. You basically dress like a woman. And often if you go, like, I remember when I lived in Syria, there was a group of guys who were obviously gay who lived in our neighborhood, and they would grow their hair long and their nails very long, and they'd wear very tight clothes. And it was a form of protection. It was like, don't worry, we are assuming this role. We are not a threat to your masculinity. It was, you see that quite a lot in parts of the world where it's really difficult to be gay. But I did think to myself, well, if in this tiny way I might break down some of the stereotype that he has of what a gay person has to look like, then I think that would be worth my time here. If the audience that is going to watch this, and you know, there are huge swathes of the United States where people still feel very strongly that homosexuality is wrong. If they're watching it, maybe they might learn something. But I think most importantly, if there are young gay people watching and they're worried about telling people they love that they're gay, then maybe they'll see someone like me on TV and worry maybe a tiny bit less. So those are the things that go through my mind when I'm working. And if I'm in a place where it's not okay to be gay, I often say, I don't know how much you care about football or soccer, but I know nothing about soccer, like literally close to zero. But as a British person, when you're abroad, you're assumed to know everything about it. You know, like this is an oracle of football in my, you know, and so everyone asks you about it and you have to kind of feign like, oh yeah, Chelsea, ha, ha, ha. And absolutely no clue, like zero. But because, you know, so you have to go through the motions. And so by the same token, if I'm in a place where there's someone who I don't imagine would be very thrilled with me being gay, and he asks if I'm married, I then just have to go through the no, you know, but you know, I'll find the one someday, or you know, like I don't. It's, and yes, is that traumatic? Is it a microaggression? You know, to use modern parlance, maybe. But I try not to judge that person. I know that I have a very happy life at home. I'm not going to get too upset if I go to a part of the world where they're not okay with me being gay. So that is also my privilege to be able to be there and not have a problem with it, because people in those who live in those places, they really do have a problem with it. When it comes to my faith, that is something I really did struggle with. I think it's one of the real reasons I came out so late. I emailed my mom when I was 24, I think, which these days is late. Given I told the first person I told I was 16. And I did think of it, if not in a conscious way, a subconscious way, of being a sin, of being like it's something wrong. I remember telling my friend Steph when I was 16 that I was gay, as though I were telling her that I had committed a crime. I was like admitting something that was wrong, and I was hoping that she wouldn't judge me. And that was really how I had internalized it. And, you know, as much as my school life was full of love and acceptance and compassion, it was, first of all, an all-boys school where homophobic tropes are just part of life. People are called gay all the time. And it was a Catholic all-boys school. So you were conscious that it is technically and remains a sin. And so I think it was a big reason why I came out late. And there were boys in my year who were out, or at least they weren't out, but everyone kind of knew they were gay. They would never be out. And their lives were hard. And I didn't want to be like them. I was reasonably, you know, I was okay academically. I played sport and I ended up becoming the head boy at the school. And there was no way on earth I would say publicly that I was gay in an environment like that. Hopefully, I mean, I like to think that things have changed. I think apparently they have. I'm still in touch. I go back to my school all the time and I love it. It's a brilliant community. And I think I know that people do come out now, which is lovely, but still identifies as a Catholic school. But I think it did set me back. And I think there are lots of religious communities where they're not as accepting as Worth has become. And it's still really, really hard. And I think it must be a really, really big issue. But I've come across gay Catholics in my life, and they've been incredibly important for me to understand if I have a faith, that it is my faith, and that it's not necessarily contingent on what the Catholic Church says or doesn't say. The issue, of course, with Catholicism is it's very dogmatic. That's kind of the point, versus other types of Christianity. So you are walking a tightrope. But again, I just come back to my grandmother. She was Catholic and she was wonderful. And that's for me, that's Catholicism.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I want to hear, you know, you started asking this big question in your 20s, and I can just feel the weight of it. You know, I have this heritage. I'm experiencing some depression, these moments of kind of suicidal ideation. What does it mean? You know, what does it mean for my life? And the book is really pulling on that thread. Could you tell us kind of what it's a very big question, but what did you find? What have you concluded about this? You know, the title is The Inherited Mind, about how much some of these things roll down the generations and what might be done for those who are asking the kind of questions that you are.
I think anybody who knows about the genetics will understand the genetic versus environmental factor equation. People talk about a 60% predisposition based on your environment versus 40% genetics. And it's broadly understood as being somehow a combination of those two things that will mean that you have some kind of mental illness. 60% environment, 40% genetics. But it's often presented as this kind of simple equation. You have, a chunk of genetics, whatever your upbringing was like, and then it'll all go into a machine and then out comes your predisposition. But what I've discovered, and there's some really interesting science happening right now, and that's why I wrote the book, is there's so much more understood about the interplay between genetics and environment, that it's not simply a question of addition or a simple equation. It's actually about how those two things intertwine and how environment activates genetics. Most people, when they think about our DNA, they think about the helix, the kind of balls on a chain, that are pairs of chromosomes that we get given by each of our parents. But that is only 2% of our DNA. The other 98% of our DNA is epigenetics. So if the 2% is the hardware, The 98% is the software. It's how those genes are activated. It's how they're turned on or turned off. One scientist called it, he said, genes is loading the gun. Epigenetics is pulling the trigger. So we cannot change our genes, but we can do something about the 98%. We can essentially turn our predispositions on or off. And what I learned in writing the book is that we not only have the power to change our epigenetic processes, we can give that power to our children, which means that, yes, we can inherit trauma, but we can also inherit healing, which I think is tremendously powerful. These issues are seen as polygenetic, so there's not one gene for any of these things. There are groups of genes. They have found the groups of genes that may account for predispositions to depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia, which I think is fascinating. And most exciting for me is that they have found how the body responds to the environment and how that impacts our genetic predispositions. And there's one example. The part of the genome where they found genes responsible for schizophrenia is on the same part of the genome where genes code for our bodily immunity, our immune system. So we might start to think of schizophrenia, for example, as being an autoimmune system issue rather than simply a mental illness. Like it could be thought of more like lupus or MS rather than, you know, a psychotic illness. And that really helps because it gives scientists the tools to refine the drugs that can really help people. Specifically in something like schizophrenia, where the drugs really haven't changed for 100 years, people are given various different degrees of lithium, which is a horrible drug for a lot of people. My dad didn't like taking it. What I found in his medical notes, I got 120 pages of his medical notes released to me, which was incredible. He hated taking his meds, which is very, very, very common among people who have psychotic illness, largely because most of the medications haven't really changed in that time. So the science that's going on at the moment is really going to help people because it can be better tailored to their own bodies and their own genetic predispositions.
One of the things that's really struck me in the book is how honest you are. And I value that so much when people can hold the complexity. And you said that actually during the writing of this book, you had to stop for a while because you had a period of depression and had to step away from it. So I don't think there's obviously not a linear case that kind of learning the science behind this illness is means that you will never again feel sad. But what you've learned and this process and unpacking your family history, how has it changed you? How has it shaped you?
I thought for a long time that my depression wasn't just depression. It was my dad's depression. That I was getting sad like him and I was getting lonely and this kind of heavy solitude, which I remember him having, like he would withdraw. I remember thinking, I have that. I don't have this amorphous idea of depression I have my dad had. And that has made it really difficult for me to come out from underneath this cloud in my family. What studying all this has shown me is how my own sadnesses are not linked in that way to him. They were his. What's mine is mine. And I have the power to undo those things myself. That has been tremendously powerful for me. I think learning more about my dad has helped me untangle that because for a long time, it was the only thing I really had to go on. I didn't know much else about him. So really having his depression was a way for me to feel closer to him. And actually that was very unhealthy. And there are all sorts of ways, and the book is not intended as a self-help book, but there is a chapter in the book, which it shows how there are things you can do in your life to generate more of these longevity cells, which a scientist in the book explains will help you stay away from illness. David Sinclair is a famous Harvard professor who talks about longevity genes and about how you can do things in your life to generate more of the chemicals that will keep you healthier for longer. There's a lot of science around inflammation. For a long time, we thought inflammation was a good thing. Inflammation meant disease control. Actually, reducing inflammation in the body is really important. And there's a lot of ways that you can do that in your life to reduce inflammation that has an impact on your mental illness and your mental health as well. So, I think you're absolutely right. Writing the book doesn't suddenly mean I don't get sad. But it has helped me move away from this idea of inevitability. Because what I've realized is nothing is inevitable. You have the power to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm aware that all these questions are very tender and I'm just really grateful. There's a particular point where you're talking about suicide and there is a sense you have that there are some myths about suicide or some stories that are told about suicide that you really want to push back on. What do you wish people understood about that horrifying event that touches so many people's lives?
I would say they must not think of it as a selfish choice made for the person's own welfare. A person who ends their life is not doing it for them. My dad, I think, did it for us. He felt that he was a burden on us. So I really want people to move away from the idea that, you know, these are choices people make about themselves, because often it's a decision that people make to unburden the people they love. That's how they think about it. When I was really at one of my lowest points, I remember a friend of mine telling me about her brother-in-law who'd ended his life. Her sister had drawn the curtains back and seen her husband hanging from a tree in the garden. And they had had absolutely no warning. I mean, nothing. They did not have any idea that there was something going on. And she said to me, she looked at me stricken. She said, how can he have done that? What was he thinking? And I remember thinking, I knew exactly what he was thinking. He was trying to unburden his family. It wasn't about him. Mm. I'd also like people to think really much more about people who have mental illness. We talk a lot these days around mental health, and that's great. I think that's brilliant. You know, Mental Health Day, wonderful. But it's given us permission to ignore people who have serious mental illnesses, and there are a lot of them. And there a lot of people will have people in their own families who have something much more than a stress-induced depressive episode. They have clinical depression, or they have psychotic bipolar disorder, or they have schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia. These are not things that a walk in the park or a bowl of blueberries are going to help. You know, we've got to think really strongly about how we help people who have these issues and not kind of, romanticize or, you know, put a sheen.
Sometimes trivialize.
Trivialize, absolutely, these issues because everybody has mental health. They absolutely do. We've all got mental health because we've all got brains, because we all got physical health because we've all got bodies. We don't all have mental illness. But there are a lot of people in the world who do, and a lot of people in our society who do. And investigating my dad's illness, one thing was very clear, was that he got a lot more help in the mid-1990s than he would have done now.
Mm. Channeling your how do we help people see the good and the beautiful as well as the hard, I'd love to finish with a question that's really about how do we love each other well? If people have people in their lives that have serious mental illness, what would it mean to show up for them in such a way that, God, that is just going to make me weep, that healing can travel down the generations? What is it that Alex brings you? What are the stories of people that you've seen? How do we help each other heal?
Understanding. Just understanding and not trying to force what your idea of a solution is on another person. You know, my mum spent her whole life trying to fix my dad. And really, it was never within her power to do that. What he needed was people to be alongside him and just to listen to him and to make him feel that he was loved. So often people who have significant mental illnesses are moved away from families because they're seen as being a danger. They're seeing, especially to children, that's really detrimental. You know, one of his care workers said to me, you know, in her experience, it's actually worse for the person if they are ostracized from particularly children in the family, because it that make that just kind of compounds their illness. The most beautiful story that I came across in writing this book was this guy. I speak to other people who have these issues in their families, and this Alex was his name. His mother, Monica, has schizophrenia. She's had it for her whole life, and she's in her 80s now. And Alex has grown up, and he tells the story of being walking alongside Monica her whole life, allowing her to be ill and not forcing any solutions on her. And she's never been medicated and hasn't been medicated for 25 years. She has a paranoia about shiny surfaces in the house. A lot of people who may have paranoid schizophrenia believe there are listening devices. So she has paranoid schizophrenia about the establishment, about people listening to her. So she doesn't like shiny surfaces. So they do what they can to remove the shiny surfaces in the house. She thinks moss is a listening device. So every 6 months, he and his siblings go up with these handmade harnesses onto the roof of her house and remove the moss. And the most beautiful example and slightly crazy one, a few years ago, she believed that the Emperor of Japan had left her apartment in Copenhagen. She was obsessed with this idea. It was a delusion. She wouldn't let it go. Eventually, Alex's sister said to her, "I'll take you to Copenhagen and we'll see if we can find the apartment." They went there. They spent a rainy weekend walking around, didn't find it, obviously, came back. She was devastated. The other siblings came to the house. They just loved her. And she has these moments of insight. And she said, "Maybe you were right. Maybe there wasn't an apartment." And for every delusion since, they've been able to say to her, "Do you remember when you thought there was an apartment? Maybe this is like that." And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I said to Alex, "You are your mum's medication. It's incredible what you've been able, the support and the love that you can show her. And she's not locked up in some psychiatric institution. She's living her life in the world." And I just thought that was the most beautiful thing. And of course, that requires privilege and resources. But wow, what a thing to be that love and support for a person who has something so scary going on in their minds.
We are each other's medication. James Longman, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, there was a huge amount to chew on in that conversation. And I think one of the places I want to start is I came away really glad to have heard someone reflecting ethically about their work at the level that James does. And it's a real theme in the book. I think we're in a time where becoming obvious how much responsibility media companies and media creators and media platforms, including social media platforms, how much power they wield, how much influence they have on us. And we've moved from a model where there was, at least in the UK, really quite high levels of control and standards, a kind of professional code of conduct that was broken all the time, but a sense of what good journalism was. Now we're just sort of fire hosed in the face with a slew of content. So it's always reassuring that when I hear people who are creating some of that content and, you know, creating it for mainstream news organizations, but hear them reflect on their practice, and particularly that bit, which I've often wondered about feeling extractive as you interview people who are caught up in wars and tragedies. You know, the bread and butter of James's work is flying into situations of high conflict, you know, speaking to us from Ukraine. And, I just found it quite moving, even hearing his awareness of that, even though he can't necessarily do that much about it, except try and be kind, you know, try and bring, in my language, something of a blessing into that interaction with the person he's interviewing. What else? So he's the second interview I've done recently interviewee I've spoken to recently who is very positive about boarding school. And that's helpful for me when I think about cultural stories, particularly in the last 10 years in the UK. There's been a lot on kind of boarding school syndrome and the harms of boarding school. But James and James Orr both speak very positively about it. And it reminded me of another interviewee that we are speaking to earlier this year called Chris Akabusi, a famous athlete. And he speaks in similar ways about going into the army as a young man, that there's something about structure and boundaries and discipline for some people, some temperaments at some stages of life that is really needed and really helpful and really liberatory. That's helpful for me to hear. People want the same things, you know, that deeply uncomfortable truth. That is one of the things that
James is wanting to communicate in his work. You know, whether you're a yoga instructor or in a refugee camp, we want the same things. We want safety and we want connection and we want many things for our children. If we have children, we want meaningful work, we want dignity, we want access to healthcare, we want to be healthy. You know, these things. And I do feel that, and maybe this is just me, but I do feel like one of the ways we insulate ourselves against how overwhelming that can be is to sort of tell ourselves a story that not everyone wants the same things, not everyone needs the same things. You know, people are just used to things. Not a problem for people that, and the line that went with it was, they want what we've got. Just ethically uncomfortable, helpfully, bracingly challenging to be reminded of how much, probably, if you're listening to this podcast, you have got, and how it's not that other people in the world wouldn't like these blessings, these riches, these privileges as well. Yeah, it's one of those, I think, ways I think that that kind of international storytelling can be very, very helpful for expanding our horizons. To loop back to that kind of ethics of his vocation and the editorial stuff, I had a really interesting internal battle when he was talking about, you know, not getting into this business to depress people, which surprised me because it's one of the reasons that it's one of the qualms I have about news, traditional news, is the frame that, you know, what's worth telling is what's terrible. And the way that forms us, it shapes us. But there was something about the line, you know, I give them a panda, which, while I completely understood his rationale, was sort of slightly setting off my cynicism senses. You know, is this just bread and circuses? Is this just kind of distracting people from the realities of the world by being, look over here, a panda? It was my initial reaction. And then that changed when he started talking about forgiveness. And I think the old story, certainly when I was in and around the BBC, working in newsrooms with real journalists, because I was always something slightly adjacent to that, there was this sense of journalism can be objective. It's the same with academia, right? Academia can be objective. We must take the personal out of this. We may not be moved by emotions. We are just going to report the facts as it is, just facts. In some ways, that's like a higher noble attempt, and obviously impossible, because there's no such thing as an objective person. There's all the philosophy around kind of viewpoint, all the psychology about personal embodied knowledge, that we know that no one is objective. We can only see the world from where we stand. We can only understand things according to what we've been taught and the people that we've been in relationship with. So there's no way of going out as a foreign correspondent and reporting objectively, right? You can't say. And so the example that came up was the Bataclan disaster. And part of me was thinking, was telling the one story of forgiveness somehow disingenuous? Given that, as far as we know, lots of people lost their relatives in the Bataclan terrorist attacks and didn't forgive their relatives. Is the focus on that one story of forgiveness false comfort, right? Is it misrepresentation, inaccurate, biased reporting, and really we should suck it up and stare into the void, the darkness of the world? And where I landed, as I argued with myself in my head, which I often do, was no. Because the stories that we tell matter. They help some things feel possible or legitimate and other things not. And even if only one person, and it may have been many more, forgave the killers of their loved ones in the Bataclan disaster, that is a story that needs to be told. And it does count as news because it is unusual, but also because when intense things happen to us, when we're in moments of extreme situations that we don't have a script for, that we've never been in for, that we don't know what to do, my sort of working hypothesis is the human mind goes, okay, what kind of things do people do in these situations? And we think of all the stories we've heard. We think of all the memes we've seen. We think of all the novels we've read. We think of all the half anecdotes of friends, what they did when they got cancer, what they did when their husband left them, what they did when, God forbid, they lost a child or whatever it was. And if in that mix is the story of the person who forgave the terrorist who killed their loved ones, that creates that as an imaginative possibility for us. And given that I believe forgiveness is radical disruption of the cycles of violence, and generative and beautiful and creative and transformative, I want that story in there. So maybe I want the story of the panda too. I don't know. But it was a very thought-provoking bit of the conversation. And then I think the thing I'll really take away with us is this: you can inherit trauma, but you can also inherit healing. And what that means for all of us that are trying to love each other well, parent well, or friend well, or partner well, or son or daughter well, that we can change patterns and we can pass different things down. And it always makes me think there's a very uncomfortable verse, or set of verses actually, it's a refrain in the Hebrew scriptures. And some places say something like, the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children up to the third and the fourth generation. And some of those where it says that, it follows it with, but basically, for those who have loved me, those blessings will roll down for thousands of generations. And then elsewhere it says, you know, everyone will bear their sin alone. No one will be punished for anything that their mother or father did. So it's really complex. There's been arguments over it for centuries. But I've often noticed the disparity between the sort of generational curses length and the generational blessings length, and the power, really, of the way we can bring healing to each other and restoration. And that story of Monica and the family that got around her to love her as she was, and to support her and to steady her and prevent her having to be put into an institution. And the phrase he used was, or maybe he didn't, maybe I said it, I can't remember, we are each other's medicine. And that feels a very profound thing for me to be taking away from today. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and our production team are Dan Turner, Amari Yagandrin, and Lizzie Harvey. We are a project of the think tank Theos. We would love you to go and check out Theos's wider work, including our sister podcast, Reading Our Times. And if you want to connect with us, you can find us on social media, on YouTube, and I have a Substack where you'll find my longer form writing at morefullyalive@substack.com. Thanks so much for listening.